Jean Kitson is a comedian, a writer, and a performer. Jean became nationally famous when she was part of that ABC TV comedy series called The Big Gig, where Jean inhabited several hugely popular characters, including the new agey gym bunny Candida, who seemed to embody every dopey trend of the 1980s, and the erotically repressed and eerily convincing newsreader Veronica Glenn Huntley. Not so long ago, Jean Kitson began to feel a little strange. She'd wake in the middle of the night with nameless, terrifying anxieties. She would be speaking at functions when she'd break out into terrible sweat and felt a desperate need to open a window. This was, of course, the onset of the dreaded menopause. But what really surprised Jean about this whole process was the shyness around the subject. So Jean began a 3-year process of finding out as much as she possibly could about the change of life, as it's sometimes called. She spoke to many women who are going through it or have come out the other side, and she spoke to their husbands and partners too. She wanted to find answers to questions like, will I lose my libido? What's the story with hormone replacement therapy? And, oh my God, will this thing ever end? Jean's book is called You're Still Hot to Me, and this conversation with Jean Kitson was recorded this week in Brisbane at the Brisbane Powerhouse in front of a live audience. What do men need to know about the menopausal women in their lives, Jean?
They need to know everything, Richard, right from the start. What it is, why it happens. All women go through menopause, every single woman, all around the world. And we're one of the few species that do. Our hormones fluctuate, and it is those fluctuations that bring about the symptoms, which could be willfulness and irritability and feistiness and mood swings, and it's all passing. You need to know that too, Richard. It's treatable. You need to know that we get hot flushes, so the doona goes on and off and on and off all night, and our partners get hypothermia and we get sleep deprived. A lot of women can lose their libido. Well, their libido leaves them. They don't lose their libido. They don't go, oh, you know, where did I put it?
On the bus.
left it on the bus. That's yes. Right. With George Clooney. Yeah. A man was telling me, rather poignantly, his story is, and he woke up one morning and his wife turned to him and she just said, I just want to be friends. And he went, what does this mean? Knowing what she sort of meant. And his wife actually became unrecognisable and he thought it was him. A lot of men think it's them and they've done something and they're not attractive anymore, but this is all treatable. There's HRT, there's testosterone, there's sex aids. They're fun. Indeed. You can get them to match your shoes too, apparently.
That must be quite devastating for
a man. It was devastating. It's a really poignant story, actually. And they got through it. And he survived his wife's menopause. She ended up finding the right treatment. At first, she was diagnosed with depression, which is what used to happen a lot. I mean, doctors really, a lot of doctors will prescribe antidepressants faster than they'll prescribe HRT. But you don't get depression from menopause, in my research tells me. You don't get depression from menopause, but menopause can exacerbate existing conditions you might have. So
there's often a rush anyway in society for when you're going through a change. People go, don't be sad. Take this. Don't be sad. Don't be sad.
Yes.
But of course, sadness will come at times as part of this. That's part of the cycle of it, surely.
Of course, of course. Well, grief is a part of our lives, but we're always aiming to be happier. It seems like happiness is the goal we all aim for in life, and we have to be happy. And we ask our kids, are they happy? And happiness seems to be the indicator of a successful life. And if you play your cards right, and if you make all the right decisions and choose the right partner and choose the right job, then happiness is the outcome. So when people are sad, it can be disconcerting and people get afraid, are fearful of sadness.
You say in your book you ultimately want women and men as well to understand that the process of menopause is ultimately or can ultimately be joyous. What do you mean?
Well, it's a great time of life. It's a natural stage in our lives. So we have puberty and menopause. They're the two givens in every woman's life. You get the freedom from not having to pay exorbitant prices for sanitary products anymore. So you don't have to, you're free from that. You can go out in your jeans and just a, you know, a credit card in the back pocket and a winning smile. That's all you need. It gives you that sort of freedom. You don't have to organise the time of your life around the time of the month anymore. You've got that freedom. You are often at a good time in your career. You're still at work, but you know things. You know things. You get to an age and you know stuff. You're much wiser. You know about yourself too, especially if you understand the symptoms of menopause and that sometimes your anxiety about your life or your partner or your work is really menopause symptoms, not anything else. And it's a great stage of life. And we've got, because we've got such long lives now, we've got a whole stage of our lives. It's the time to set ourselves up with our fitness, and it's like Mother Nature. The reason we get menopause, apparently, this is the most sort of accepted theory at the moment, is that we get menopause because Mother Nature is all about survival of the species, and she decided that women needed to stop reproducing and start looking after the grandchildren so that the mothers could go out and gather more and feed the tribe, because the hunters didn't really feed the tribe, apparently. The gatherers did. So Mother Nature's a bit old-fashioned, actually. So then that's why we get menopause, so we can sort of help raise other people's kids.
What was happening to you when you began to notice that things were starting to change for you?
Well, I was performing. I still do perform, and I was performing at a conference. I was the after-dinner speaker with a lot of tech heads, so mainly blokes, I have to say. So I was in a room with about 400 men, and then I started perspiring. And I thought, oh, it's not hot in here, is it? And you know, Richard, if you perspire on stage...
Flop sweat, it looks like. Flop sweat, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Flop sweat is when a performer is perspiring and it looks like they're afraid and that they're perspiring because they're anxious or fearful, and an audience can smell fear and and see fear, and it makes them uncomfortable, and then they get restless and they don't like to see fear, and then the audience attacks you and rips you apart, or they walk out and demand their money back or something like that.
Don't laugh. I've seen it happen, people.
So I was really worried that they thought I was worried. But I was worried because I also had a silk blouse on. And so I'm getting patches all over it. I look like the commando, actually. So now I've discovered the cardi. That's another great thing about menopause.
So what happened when you went to the chemist for a bit of advice?
Oh, well, then, so I was getting sleepless nights and having these hot flushes and sweats, and I thought, oh, well, I'll just go to the chemist. So I thought, this must be menopause. I'll just go to the chemist and ask for some, if they've got anything. So I went into our local pharmacy, and I approached one of the mature, possibly menopausal, well-groomed women behind the counter, and I said, oh, you know, I'm getting really hot at night, and just these sort of, you know, waves of heat, and the doona's going on and off, and I get in and out of the shower, in and out, and my husband remembers, he says to me, you know, remember when in and out didn't mean the shower? You know, I hope that's not too racy, Richard. And she looked at me, so this lady looked at me, and she glanced furtively around the shop, and she leant over the counter and she whispered, hot flushes. In fact, she didn't whisper it, she mouthed it, hot flushes, as if she was saying, your nipple is showing. As if it was a cause for embarrassment.
So you weren't embarrassed at that point, but she suddenly was, and then did you feel embarrassed?
Well, I thought, why is she embarrassed? Why could anyone be embarrassed about menopause? I had no idea it was a secret. I had no idea. No idea that people didn't talk about it. Mind you, when I thought about it, I realised that none of my friends had ever talked about it, and no one, and my mother never talked about it. I rang my mother and I said, Mum, did you go through menopause? And she said, oh, yes, it was the worst 5 years of my life. And I said, 5 years? I said, I didn't know that. And then when I look back, I realised she handled menopause extremely well. She'd come home from work, she'd grab a bottle of dry sherry, she'd sit in the corner... She'd rock backwards and forwards, and she'd say things like, I didn't get any dinner tonight, just pick some chocos off the back fence.
She went through it for 5 years and didn't really talk to you about it at all. What does that tell us about how we speak about such things?
Well, I've thought about it so much. Why was it a secret? In modern women, it's probably that they feel it's a sign of growing old, whereas actually it's about growing up. It's a getting of knowledge and wisdom about ourselves and each other. That's why it's great to share it with the people in your lives, you know, the men, your children, your employers, employees, your bartender, your hairdresser. Share it with everyone. But in the old days, of course, at the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s, in those days, if you got a bit willful and irritable, a bit feisty, if you, you know, didn't want the burnt chop anymore and you stood up for yourself and you, you know, you released your inner anger, you were tired of being reasonable, you could be locked up. You could be diagnosed with climacteric insanity and could be locked up and treated as insane and given cold baths and radioactive rods put up your vagina if you were flooding, which sometimes happens with menopause. You were given shock treatment and opium. Oh, yeah. And they'd shave your head. So I think there
what menopause was, if you opened your mouth about it, it was seen as this kind of psychiatric disorder that was treated by the insertion of radioactive rods in women?
Yeah, well, one of the symptoms of menopause can be flooding, unusual changes in your period, and sometimes it just stops and you never see it again. And as one woman said, it was like not being able to say goodbye to an old friend. But back to the old days, that's how it was treated. So if a woman was willful and irritable, she got locked up. If a man became willful and irritable, he was elected to Parliament. So it's true. Those stories are true. So I think the women through the generations became very, very quiet about it. And don't forget our longevity. We, you know, many women up until the last 100, 200 years would die before they reached menopause, which is what's happening overseas, you know. People talk about culturally where, oh, only Western women get menopause, and people roll their eyes as if we're all, you know, indulged and wimpy and, you know. But every woman of every race goes through menopause if she lives long enough.
As you said, when women are experiencing menopause, often they're at the peak of their careers, and you found yourself in a situation where you really do need to show authority, because that's really what's going on when you're doing a stage performance. Suddenly you have this hot flush. Did you hear other stories of women who are trying to be in a situation where they're trying to look calm and authoritative, and suddenly they feel a hot flush coming over them, they break out in a sweat?
Absolutely. That was a really interesting part of my research, was women, menopausal women at work. And because no one speaks about it in the workplace. One woman I spoke to, who is from a university, said, we've got policies for parental leave, sick leave. They've got things in place to help you through these difficult periods of your life, and there's no policy about menopause. There's no one speaks about it. And that's at a university where they're fairy, you know, progressive.
Well, there'd be a good reason for that, wouldn't there? Because any time a woman in that position would make a decision that was unpopular, there'd be sort of sniggering and remarks made behind her back, oh, yeah, she's menopause, or that's why she said something I didn't like.
Exactly, exactly. It's an excuse for derision. And that used to be, you remember when blokes would roll their eyes and go, oh, she's on the rags, if she snapped at someone. Remember that awful, awful expression? Well, no one uses that anymore, because if you did, you would be seen for what you are, a jerk. You know, like, so you don't want to look like a jerk, because periods are seen as normal and natural and a part of the natural cycle of life, and they're talked about on TV, and boyfriends and girlfriends talk about periods. They share what's going on and what's not going to go on for the next few days. They're plot lines, like when he's got a tampon in his pocket and, you know, it's not her time of month. And we have to get to that stage with menopause. We have to share it with the people. We have to share it at work, because we have to get to the stage where someone can't roll their eyes behind your back and say, it's, you know, oh, she's menopausal. And I suggest to women that they just look at their employee in the eye and say, it's not menopause, it's you. Now go and get me a coffee.
And then she should stab him to death with a Bowie knife. We were talking there about symptoms. Another symptom is anxiety. What kind of stories did you hear about that? And did you experience it yourself?
I've had anxiety. Anxiety is this sort of low-lying thing where you wake up in the night and go, oh, my God, I'm anxious. What am I anxious about? Where are the kids? So you get up and you go and count the kids. Oh, no, the kids are home. oh, was that a noise? Oh, no, I don't know whether. Was that something in the roof? You know, was that someone in the house? Why hasn't the dog barked? You know, is the dog still alive? You know, it's sort of these night thoughts that you go through and you just build up this terrible anxiety you can. And really, it's a symptom of menopause. It's not really anxiety. Or anxiety about work. People think they're not coping at work and they lose confidence, and women can lose confidence and their self-esteem during this time, and they think it's a symptom of work or what they're doing, but it's a menopause symptom. It's really interesting. And we know that about pubescent kids. We know that their emotions are going to go wild, and we know that they're unsure of themselves, and we know that girls are going to be really insecure, and we cut them a lot of slack. So we've got to understand that about menopause and manage it. And we can manage it, which is great, because we are still living very, you know, full-on lives. Most of us have kids still at home. We can't go into a corner and grab a bottle of dry sherry.
You mentioned hormone replacement therapy there, and there was a report that came out in 2002 that found a link between HRT and breast cancer. Where's the science now, Jean, to your best understanding? Neither you or I a scientist, I should say this, but on your reading and your study of it, where is the science now on HRT?
Well, there's been a new study, a worldwide study, and I've just recorded a verbatim in the book, and also all the people that were at the table for this study, all the people involved in it. And the latest science is that they believe that HRT, the previous study was flawed because of the women they used in the study. Some of them were much older. But the science is now that HRT has more health benefits than risks for most women if you take it within the first 6 years, 6 to 10 years of menopause. So if you take it earlier rather than later, and just take it for as long as you need to manage your symptoms, then the benefits outweigh the risks. That's for most women. But you've got to have a good doctor. One of my main messages, and as Richard just said, you know, I'm not a doctor or a scientist, so I'm not pretending to have the answers, but one of the best things you can do for yourself is get a good GP. Get a really good GP. You know, they have to know you and know what's going on for you, and know whether this is a menopause symptom or whether you're always anxious and paranoid or whatever.
Indeed, one of the creepier aspects of the HRT program when it began was the drug companies behind it made ads on American television which kind of implied that menopause was an illness, and if you took a drug for it, it could make you better. What do you think about that whole idea of selling the whole idea of menopause as an illness, something that you can take a pill to fix?
Terrible, terrible. It's not an illness, but it can make you feel ill for all sorts of reasons, all the reasons I've said. But it's not an illness. It's a fantastic time of life. It's an incredible time of life. It's such a sense of freedom and optimism. And we can start looking outside our family again and looking at our friendships, except we might have let drop by the way. Your husband comes up the list a bit more, you know, less down the list of priorities. And you can get to know your husband again. I mean, I talk about my parents in there. I don't even know whether to say it, but they said I could. So
yeah, go ahead. Say what you like.
Well, I was having some Chinese food with my parents at the local leagues club, and my mum's nearly 90 and my dad's 88. And they were saying, oh, you know, there's not many partners, many married people, many partners in our group. You know, and I said, well, from my experience, because I was all caught up with menopause, it's all about me. I said, from my experience in my research of menopause, a lot of marriages break up around menopausal time because a lot of women lose their libidos, and if they don't take treatment, then your whole relationship needs renegotiating, and some people can do that successfully and some can't. And then Mum said, well, that didn't happen to us. And I went,
whoa.
I said, pardon? And she said, well, we didn't have to renegotiate anything. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, we still have... Can't even say it. That's my parents. And I looked at them. His mum tucking into the garlic prawns all by herself. She won't share them. And... And she said, oh, yes, I was smiling to myself the other day when you and your sister said I looked well. And I thought to myself, well, that's because I'd had sex this week. And I'm saying this story, and I asked Mum, because it's a really inspiring story. And I said, probably hopefully as a daughter, but I didn't even think you liked sex. You know, I didn't know this. You know, I was getting really disturbed, weirdly. And she said, oh, there's a time in your lives when there's a lot going on and you may have money stresses and kids are at home and there's a lot of pressure on your life and you're busy and menopause and things, and you don't feel like it, and that all drops by the wayside, but you can, you know, rediscover intimacy again. And I love that story. So, you know, I mean, I don't really love it. They're my parents.
I was going to say, they're your parents. They're your parents talking about having sex with each other in front of you.
Well, can I tell you, Richard, I just built a granny flat. under the house. But it's a really nice granny flat, and I built it so that the bedroom didn't have a door so they could lie there and look at the garden. I'm listening to them thinking, I'm going to have to put a door on the granny flat. And then my daughter, my 22-year-old, is at home with her boyfriend, and I was thinking, there's going to be sex in this house everywhere. My husband and I are going to be the only people in the house not having sex. Talk about the sandwich generation.
Was part of you tempted to look at your father and go, stop touching my mother?
Yeah. Well, I had to go home. I was sort of had my fingers in my ears going, I don't want to hear it anymore. And I was telling a friend and she said, no wonder there's so many accidents on the M1 coming from the Central Coast where all the retirees are. She said, that's where everyone's kids go and find out their parents are still having sex and they're driving home in shock.
Your family goes right back, don't they? They go way back to the First Fleet, the Second Fleet?
Second Fleet, the Second on my mum's side, yeah.
What do you know about your ancestor?
I know that my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was reportedly the first white man to drown in Sydney Harbour. Yeah, he was cutting rushes for the roof of his house, probably at Rush Cutters Bay, actually. and he slipped in and he drowned, which was sad. It would have been sad for his wife, only she got married about a week later. I don't think there were many, many women in the colony at that stage.
Your mum sounds like an amazing woman.
Yeah, my mum is amazing. My mum is amazing. I mean, even that she said I could talk about her and my dad is amazing. She grew up in the country, a real country girl. She had to leave school at 14, but she's self-educated. She reads like a demon and she's a very smart woman. And she didn't get married till she was 32, which was way past it in those days. And she met my dad coming back from England on the boat and they started a romance and they ended up getting married. And Mum was an amazing feminist. She sort of railed against domesticity. All my friends' mothers cooked and cleaned and sewed, and not my mum.
Not your mum? How was she as a cook?
My mum, when she was first married, she made Dad a chocolate cake to be nice, and he nailed it to the kitchen wall. And she couldn't sew, and I remember when I was given my first bikinis, a two-piece really, but they mesh in the middle, and I said, Mum, you know, they're not bikinis unless there's a gap. So she said, oh, all right, well, I know what I'll do. I just cut off the top elastic and fold them down and then put the elastic back in, and that'll make the gap, you know, a bit more racy. So I went to bed, and the next morning she said, here, try them on, but instead of cutting the top out, she'd cut one of the legs out and folded that in. And I was half in and half out of my first bikinis. And the half that was out was illegal at my age.
I know you've always been a petrol head. You've been absolutely mad about cars most of your life. Did you get that from your dad?
Yeah. Dad is a mechanic and he's one of those gifted people who... Dad loves manuals. He buys manuals at the op shop. He built his own racing car and he had his own BMC dealership when we were growing up called Roy Kitson Motors, and he loved English cars.
And how old were you when you got behind the wheel for the first time?
About 12.
12.
Yeah, Dad would take us for drives, and then he wouldn't just teach us how to drive. He'd go, all right, faster, faster, faster. And then he'd go, we'd be coming to a T-intersection. He'd be going, okay, your brakes have failed. Try stopping using the gears. And we'd be going, no, don't use the brakes. Just change it. And then he'd go, then he'd teach us. It was like advanced driving with your dad.
And so did you just keep right on driving from the age of 12?
Well, Mum used to say, gee, could you go and get some milk? Just park around the corner where no one can see you. And this is a small town. There was only 3,000 people in Sorrento when I was growing up, so everyone knew I was parking around the corner. So I could just about see over the wheel, and I'd park around the corner. And then when I went to get my licence at a legal age, the local policeman said, well, I know you can drive.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. On air, online and on digital. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
Today, it's a conversation with Gene Kitson, comedian and author, that was recorded at the Brisbane Powerhouse. Gene's the author of a book called You're Still Hot to Me, The Joys of Menopause.
You had a crack for a while at being a teacher in the country. How did that go, Gene?
Terrible, Richard. Terrible? Thanks for asking. My first year out was my last year out. I mean, the one thing we didn't learn at Teachers College was how to teach. I don't think I ever did anything about how to teach. It was about how to write and perform and, you know, and how to have great fun and explore our creative urges, but not how to teach. So I applied for a job with the Schools Commission taking the arts to disadvantaged areas. And I was based in Oyen in northwest Victoria, which is dry, flat, red earth, you know, wheat country. We had something like 5 pubs and 5 petrol stations and 1 general store.
And what did you tell yourself when you went to live in the country?
Oh, well, I wanted to live a country life. First of all, I wanted to just sort of get out of the city, and I liked country kids. And then I thought, I'm going to live a country life. And I had this image of a country life, the city TV version of a country life, of course. So I got a farmhouse and no electricity, no telephone. This was the days before mobile phones. It was 10 miles out of Oyen on my own. I got 4 chooks. I called them Henry because they all looked the same. And I named them after the only chook poem I knew. Henry had a little hen. He called her Henrietta. When Henrietta ceased to lay, Henrietta. And the chook house was fallen down, but I didn't see the problem because they were going to be free-range chooks. And I had this image of myself sort of living the country life in a flimsy cotton slip, you know, carrying a hand-woven basket over my arms, reaching up to pluck plump, juicy pears from branches laden with fruit, digging a garden, growing tomatoes and shaking the hard earth from the potatoes and the sprawling vines of zucchini and pumpkin and the bright yellow bells of capsicum. I was going to have a country garden that would make angels cream their corn with envy. So I started on the garden, and it took me a week to dig 1 square metre of dirt. And this is during a drought too. And when I tried to water the little seedlings of vegetables, the water would just disappear into the parched earth, leaving the only the tiniest wet spot for a moment or two, like a one-night stand. And there was only 1 pear on the tree. And although I had a lemon tree covered with lemons, and I got from the kids at school recipes about lemon marmalade and lemon, you know, preserved lemons and lemon butter, I couldn't light the stove because it took me 4 hours to chop 1 mallee root. And even then it was too big to fit in the fire stove, the firebox. And I was lonely. And I ended up every weekend lying under the lemon tree with a bottle of tequila and a packet of salt. I didn't get through much salt.
But at last you were having a good time. You started performing on stage at Le Joke, which was Above the Last Laugh in Melbourne, sadly closed, long gone now. And I remember at that time there was, like I say, a lot of comedians. Do you remember that all-important moment when you make that decision where you're going to go on stage and try and be funny?
Yes.
And how terrifying that is.
It's terrifying. And I didn't want to do it. I didn't have any intention of doing it, but I couldn't get an audition to do a safe play with other people and in character. And I couldn't get an audition, so I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get a job is to be seen to be doing something. And the only place I could go on stage and do anything was at Le Joke, which had tryout nights. So I wrote, I didn't do stand-up as me. I'm not as brave as all the stand-up comedians who go, hi, you know, and I had a character. And I thought to myself, well, which character is going to be able to handle this situation the best? What sort of person is not going to care what an audience thinks and be immune to the audience, really? And I thought, a stripper. Because I thought, they must be amazing strippers. They must really have something in them that they can do all that and not be worried what people think, basically. And so I wrote a character called Bubbles, and she was a stripper, and she'd arrived at Le Joke. It's really pathetic. I'm sorry I'm telling you this. But she'd arrived at Le Joke thinking it was Le Jock. The terror was being alone on stage. So I also employed the services of a very patient, understanding friend who played the piano accordion, Charlie. It worked on the level of people quite enjoyed it, and I got booked to do it again, and I did it one more time, I think. And then I met all the wonderful people from Let the Blood Run Free. And
yeah, this was a kind of a mistake of a hospital drama, and there was tons and tons of absurd amounts of gore and blood. And you did this with Brian Nankervis, as I recall, who's now you see on Rock Quiz all the time, and the amazing Linda Gibson. The late Linda Gibson.
Yeah.
Who's obviously a really important influence on you in comedy. Tell me what Linda was able to, I don't know, being with her and working with her, how she was able to influence what you do, Jeannie.
Oh, Linda was the most fearless performer I'd ever seen, the most fearless woman, and physically so anarchic, you wouldn't know what was happening next, and hilarious, I mean really funny, and she kept upping the ante. And I remember the first time she ever licked a bench someone had just sat on. It sounds gross, but I'm just trying to give you a picture, but it was hilarious. This was in character. She was matron conniving bitch, and anyone who saw Let the Blood Run Free, that was always their favourite character. And she would just take us all to another level of absurdity. And she was brilliant and a great friend. And we, you know, I still lived in a communal house with her till I was 35 or something. That's the life of a comedian.
We started on the big gig together in 1989, which was produced by Ted Robinson.
Fantastic.
You had two, well, several characters, but the most outstanding ones, I think, were Veronica Glenn Huntley, the newsreader, and Candida. Which is still
fondly remembered.
Yeah.
That's so nice.
I love the way with Candida you were able to infect her with about everything that was wrong with the 80s.
Nice use of the word infection. it was fun to do. I remember going to Ted and to get a gig on the big gig, you had to write your own material and bring something along. And I had this character at the time called Duna, who is a new age sort of airhead. And I remember talking to Ted, you know, he said, what character you got? And I said, oh, I got Duna, she's new age airhead. And he said, what's new age? And I went, you know, crystals or essential oils and, you know. And he said, oh, we're looking for someone who can do something physical. Oh, she's physical. Could she also be, go to the gym? And I said, sure, you know, I'm not going to knock back television to go, oh, no, I don't think she can go to the gym. I don't think my character would do that. I went, yes, of course she can go to the gym. And I did Candida in all those years in that Lycra, having never been to a gym. And I've since been to a gym and I could kick myself because there's so much more material. I can't believe I missed out on that, you know, wealth of... And I also did, you know, the air hostess, yes. Rose McLeod, which was, of course, written by... Well, he wasn't my husband at the time, but Patrick Cook. So everything changed for me on the big gig because I met my husband, Patrick Cook, and he wrote Veronica Glenn Huntley as well.
And yes, and of course, Veronica the whole time was had all this kind of intensely, only slightly repressed Miss Moneypenny-ish kind of sexual energy to her, talking about this sportsman called Wayne Lightning Truscott. And it's only in retrospect, thinking about it the other day, I realised Patrick was writing himself into that role. Wasn't he?
Well, at some stage he must have written himself out. I have to look back because then there was Aldo Rubber Hip Spinetti, another sportsman. But, yes, he might have been... I was certainly performing for Patrick, I have to say. Oh, don't, I mean, you know... Yeah, you know what I mean.
Oh, hey, blow up, you people, please.
Thank you, Richard.
I think my favourite line of Candida's, she always had that vague environmental awareness where she talked about global warming being caused by all the F's and C's in the atmosphere. In more recent years, you've had a lot to do with palliative care issues. I know recently your mother-in-law, Sheena, had a heart attack last year. Just tell me that story about how that unfolded.
Sheena is my beloved mother-in-law, and she seemed quite well. And anyway, she had a heart attack, and we knew by getting a call and saying she'd been taken to hospital and had a heart attack. So, and then she had a stent put in, and then she was in hospital, and she was there for about 7 days, I think, or a bit less. And she seemed to be getting better, and we were preparing for her to come home, and then she died. So she died in hospital. And I have to say that I haven't had much experience of death. And then 2 days later, I did a palliative care conference up in Cairns. And I'd just been through this experience with Sheena about death and being confused. And she was in the hospital room and I didn't know whether to take the kids. And I didn't know whether you were supposed to see a dead person. I didn't know. Then when I did...
You didn't know whether you were supposed to see a dead person?
No. Well, because I came from... my grandfather lived with us for years and years and he had emphysema and we used to, you know, boil his hankies in a pot on the stove. It sounds like we're from, you know, the 1800s, but that's... And he hardly really spoke to us, my grandfather, but we looked after him at home as he got sicker and sicker. And the kids would... I mean, this is going to sound really terrible and I'm not trying to say it to sound terrible, but it's just the truth. We used to give Grandpa a cup of tea. One of us would hold the tea while we'd lift him out of bed and we'd take his pyjamas off him and we were quite young and we'd hold the cup of tea and someone would hold a bowl under his bowels because it would go straight through him. So that was palliative care at its most primitive and ignorant. But that's what you did. You looked after people at home. And then when he got too sick to be able to help, he went to a nursing home. But we kids never visited him in the nursing home. Mum and Dad did, but we didn't. All we knew is we got home from school one day and he was gone. And then he died. Well, I think he died. I'm not sure. He could have gone to Rio. I have no idea. We weren't even really told. We didn't go to his funeral or anything. And occasionally we'd drive past the Dramana nursing home and Mum and Dad would say, wave to Grandpa. So we drove past. We just never... Our family was very frank about a lot of things, but death and dying, we didn't speak about that sort of thing. And so I didn't know how to handle someone dying.
So when Sheena died, you didn't really have any bearings then?
Well, the only bearing I had was the year before, 2 years before, my father-in-law had died and he was in an open coffin and I'd never seen that before. And I didn't look, but my kids went up and looked, but I didn't look because I was way outside my experience. So when Sheena died, I knew you could look. I didn't know anything. I didn't know you could lie in bed with your loved one and rearrange them and do their hair and dress them up and kiss them. And I didn't know you could touch a person who had died. I mean, we don't even call it death anymore. People are very afraid of death and grief. And I think you protect your children. I feel like we were protected as kids from the bad things in life, in case, as we talked earlier, in case that made us unhappy and we had unnecessary grief.
It's absolutely true. People can't even bring themselves to say the word death or died anymore. They're even retreating from passed away, and they say he passed now. It's getting more and more euphemistic, and it's weird.
It's weird. I'm sorry to hear your father is a euphemism.
Yes.
You know? But when I went to the palliative care conference, it was absolutely an eye-opener. It was brilliant. And I thought, that's what we all need, general public need, is to go to palliative care to understand about dying and to talk about it and to talk about how we want to die. And even after my first palliative care conference, and then I did another one, and then Palliative Care Nurses Australia asked if I would be their patron, and I was so very thrilled and very humbled to say yes, because they, in palliative care, it's the nurses that do everything. By the time you're ready to die, you don't see a doctor again because there's nothing they can do. So it's the nurses that help you through those stages, which is what happened to me when my cousin, lovely Malcolm Collar, died of a brain tumour last year. So by then I'd learnt a lot more about death and dying and palliative care and about really sort of trying to, all the services that are available, people that can help you. Malcolm had just found the love of his life at the Adelaide Festival. He'd met his soulmate and she'd met her soulmate. So Malcolm was my age, like 58, but he met Anna when he was 56 and she was quite a bit younger, but they were soulmates. And he got diagnosed with a brain tumour when she found out she was pregnant with their only child. It was really a very difficult, sad time. So we, in palliative care, we had... He saw his son born. Orlando was 4 months old by the time he died, dying there. But I always, I mean, I really thought when someone died, you changed the subject, you cheered them up. And I think it comes from a generation who went through the war and were told after the war to come home, forget all about it, get on with their lives, and that's what people did. They didn't talk about mourning and the grief of war and the loss of their comrades and what they'd seen. You didn't talk about it. You might have talked about it with each other, but you didn't talk about it with your kids. And then, of course, later on, when you're older, it can become much more overwhelming once again. But I think maybe that's the reason that we didn't talk about it. And so then it becomes a fearful thing. And I was thinking we just need to find the rituals that suit us. And my sister asked my parents how they wanted to die. My mum said to me years ago that she thought she was dying. I realised she was menopausal. She goes, she gathered us all in the room. She said, kids, I think I haven't got much time. I think I'm going to die young. And we all said, why? What's wrong, Mum? What's the doctor said? Oh, the doctor hasn't. I haven't seen a doctor. I've just got this feeling. So she's going to be 90 this year. And she always said to me, Jean, if I get sick and I'm dying, I want you to turn off the machine. Promise me you'll turn off the machine. And I don't know what machine she was talking about. Possibly the iron. She's an amazing ironer. But, so now I realise we have to talk about these things.
Jean, you and I have known each other since, I actually think it's 1986 when we first met, when at the Adelaide Festival, when you were doing Let the Blood Run Free at the time.
Yes,
the
I think so, yeah.
And so I still have, it still completely blows my mind that you have an adult daughter. I don't think, it's kind of really, does it still blow your mind, the whole idea that you've got one adult daughter and one who's approaching adulthood rapidly? And what do they do for you? How do they keep you in check, your two daughters?
Well, you know, like all mums, I'm really proud of my daughters. They are amazing young women, incredible young women. I'm so really lucky, blessed to have them as daughters. They've both got their feet on the ground. They're really exceptionally kind, sensitive, intelligent, beautiful young women.
Now that we've and got that I out say the way, that, though,
yeah. Yes. And I'm not biased at all. When I first had Victoria, I was still doing television. And those were the days of the super mum, when you said, you know, you could be a mother and a wife and a CEO and, you know, a sex goddess and a domestic goddess and, you know, everything. And that's what when you could do it all. And for some reason, some women, they've got all those boxes ticked in their lives. But for most women, that is completely impossible. You find you can't do all that. Something has to give. And I was doing all, I was working, and I thought what happened is you had a baby, and then the baby just came along. Your life didn't change in any way. It only was your life with the addition of a baby, and you just brought your baby along to work, and your life continued in the way it always had, except with the addition of a baby. And I had this image that you had the baby, and then you would breastfeed the baby, and the baby would breastfeed and fall into a deep milky slumber, and the mother would gaze off and get that wistful, motherly, maternal look in her eyes, and then the baby would have a nap, and then the mother would press on doing whatever the mother does, you know, running the Department of Finance or hand-knitting yogurt or whatever she does. Well, the only yogurt I made was my baby's vomit coagulating on my dressing gown lapels, because my baby didn't sleep. She didn't drink and sleep. She drank and she screamed. You know, before I had a baby, I thought reflux was a vacuum cleaner. So I realised I was really stressed. You know, I fed her in the ABC studios dressed as a rabbit. She had 16 nipples to choose from. I just used to take her in. Ernie Dingo serenaded her with a vacuum cleaner pipe. Richard and Tim and Paul, I don't know whether you remember this, you gave her her first Barbie. You'd used it as a prop. And he came into the dressing room and gave it to my daughter. She ended up with about 56 Barbies, mostly, you know, salvaged from op shops, saved, as Patrick says. But I realised that it was really stressful, and I wasn't being a good mother, and I didn't think I was being the mother I wanted to be. And I wasn't enjoying motherhood, and I was trying to have another baby, which took a while, so there's a 7-year gap between Victoria and Charlie. And I thought, why am I trying to be a mother when I'm not actually, I'm so stressed, and I was getting, you know, nannies and things. And I thought, they're having more fun than me. I'd come home and they'd be playing with Victoria, and I'd be making the cup of tea and doing the dinner and feeding the nanny and the baby. And I'm going, you're crazy. Something's wrong with this picture. So I ended up stopping most of the stressful work I was doing and changing the way I worked and really putting much more focus into enjoying motherhood, which I love, because I thought I was proud of the work I'd done, I'd had fun, and I'd done enough to just let it go and just make sure that my kids have the best possible start and support that they could. I'm sounding really noble now, but, you know, actually it was much easier being at home. No, it was just something I really wanted to do and get the balance right.
Just finally, one more important menopause question. There's only perhaps half a page dedicated in your book to the really important phenomenon that is the male menopause. Jean, you haven't ignored it completely. You have given it about half a page. It's more of a kind of a sidebar sort of thing.
Yes.
After detailed, thoughtful, comprehensive research into the phenomenon that is the male menopause, what did you conclude?
I came to the conclusion, and science is with me on this, that male menopause is a myth. There is no such thing as male menopause.
God almighty, I'm in a room full of man flu skeptics too, I can see it.
Well, if you want to be pedantic, there's andropause, where testosterone levels can drop. But menopause is when, you know, your fertility drops, all those other things. For instance, do men's balls drop like our breasts do? No, already down and dirty. Do they grow hair in hilarious places like shoulder, neck, chin? No, they went through that at the same time they were getting pimples. Do they prefer soft furnishing to sex? No. Do they experience a genuine thrill watching Antique Roadshow? No. No, there is no such thing as male menopause. But I have to say the only almost comparable thing is hair loss. And men have embraced that now. Men shave their heads. They're fine with hair loss. They don't have rugs and comb-overs anymore. Whole football teams are bald. Accounts departments are bald. And I think if they can embrace baldness, we can embrace menopause.
Hear, hear. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Jean Kitson.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.